Danger. The emergency destruct system is now activated.
Cake and grief counseling will be available at the conclusion of the test.
She's alive! Alive!
Maybe you should put some shorts on or something if you want to keep fighting evil today.
Why not just put a stake through her heart?
She's not a vampire.
Well, you'd be surprised how many things that'll kill.
We are now seeing the beginnings of another stage of human evolution. At last, we can retire and give up this life of crime.
You and your training wheels.
Hailing frequencies are open.
Hello, sweetie.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffy and Fanny Show.
Terminator and Terminator 2 Judgment Day. Come with me if you want to wisp.
Oh, God. I don't even know anymore.
Perfect. You've channeled Paul.
I'm Sean.
I'm Mike.
I'm Rachel.
And we have a very special guest today, Brad Bollier. Hello, Brad.
Hello. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. Now, we asked if you'd love to be a part of this, and you said you were a fan of these movies.
I was, indeed. I am. I saw them way back when, you know, back in, like, high school, or before high school, I think it was, and went back and watched them again, you know, to refresh my memory for the show, and it was pretty fun, interesting looking at them now and comparing it to what I remember from back then. That it was a pretty big difference, actually.
Oh, that's going to be interesting. Okay, well, I'm sure we'll get some of that out as we go through this.
Yeah.
So we're talking about both Terminator and Terminator 2. This is part of our women and non-binary and SFF tour, as it were. And we're going to start by talking about Terminator, the first film, the classic film. And I'm going to give it to you, Brad, to describe the plot of this movie. You weren't expecting this, but now the heat's on.
Well, for the first Terminator movie, there's a war in the future, and humanity is being overcome by these cybernetic robots, and one of them is sent back in time to kill the mother of the person who sort of leads the resistance. And so we see Arnold coming back as that Terminator, and then the resistance also sends back a hero of their own to save her, who's played by Michael Bain. And so what we see is essentially a long, tense chase, between the Terminator, Arnold, and, the savior, played by Michael Bain to save Sarah Connor, so that she can in fact give birth to John Connor and the resistance will, in the end win. So that's kind of it in a nutshell.
Yeah, I think it's not a very complicated plot.
In essence, not really. I mean, I think the strength of the movie was the idea itself was very unique for me at the time, and I think it's still a very interesting central thread, the main conceit of the story, you know, coming back in time to try to change it and having another, you know, the resistance side try to stop that. But I think it was, you know, it was really kind of a long chase. It had an interesting, you know, technological aspect, with it as well. So for me, it was like, I think the first time I had this really strong sort of thriller adventure movie mixed with a strong science fictional angle.
Yeah. And this has the distinction of being, one of the films for which Harlan Ellison sued someone and won. In case you didn't see it in the credits, Harlan Ellison is thanked for his work in the most vaguest of terms, because Cameron basically hated Harlan Ellison.
Oh, really? Yeah, that he had written something called Soldier, wasn't it?
Yeah, something like that. Yeah,
that's
sued and won, and for all time, all Terminator. I don't know if it's the other ones, but certainly the first one have to mention Harlan Ellison now. So, I think it's amusing having seen that and just thought like, well, that's a weird, vague way of saying you're thanking him for his work, without saying anything specific.
Right.
So,
yeah.
So to kind of head off the discussion, we're each going to have our own little piece to talk about for each film. And my first piece is actually going to be about the special effects of the first film of Terminator, as has been described already. And if you, everyone knows Terminator, they know it's a cyborg robot monster. But watching this film again and again has made me really appreciate 80s science fiction, because all of the effects here are practical effects, right? They're robotic puppets. They're, some like cosmetic play, right? With even the in the future scenes, right? They're all models in a sort of, presumably a miniatures landscape in some sequences and then using green screen, for other sequences. And this is something that transfers over even into Terminator 2, although, that one does have more advanced, special effects. And I love that the special effects here, while, you know, they're dated in some respects, like some of the robotic heads kind of look a little funky. You can tell they're not actually Arnold's head, but they're still remarkably complex and really well done. And it's something I love about 80s films that when they go to make special effects, so many of them didn't have the technology to do the kinds of things they do now, which I think sometimes make directors lazy. Because they can make anything CG now, so they don't have to actually think about the restrictions that come with a film like this, which is a relatively low budget film by comparison to, say, Star Wars, and yet also has some of the most complicated and really quite incredible robotics work. I mean, even if we just ignore the Futurescape, where we have, you know, flying machines and these giant rolling robotic, whatever you call those, I can't remember what they're called, like hunter killers or whatever, these massive treaded machines. But if we go to even just that scene where Arnold basically cuts his eye out, it's shot really well. It's really quite beautiful, the shot, because they're very clever in how they kind of seamlessly merge Arnold's actual head with the robotic head. And the image is really disturbing and creepy. That eye, that first time we see that red eye, is a creepy moment, because you realize, yeah, he is full-on robot and he is not a thinking machine. So that's kind of more or less what I wanted to bring up, is just how much I appreciated the special effects and how good they still are. Even though we're 30 years out, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, 31? I guess it is, yeah.
Holy crap, this movie's old.
Yeah, 84.
And it really holds up. So, Rachel, you had a hand first, and so we'll jump to you, and then we'll go to Brad.
Just kind of like as a clarifying thing, because you mentioned green screen. If I recall correctly, it's actually blue screen, because I don't think green screen was really brought into use until digital cameras were more utilized, because the green screen registers better for digital cameras, and for regular film cameras, it was blue screen. So...
Well,
now,
this is
more really, you know.
This is really embarrassing, Rachel, because I am actually incapable of seeing blue, so I just see all green. So
I'm so sorry.
No, I'm just kidding. I'm
sad sound for Sean. Wah, wah.
Wah, wah.
What about you, Brad?
You had mentioned, so like the effects, I agree. There's a whole bunch of them that I was like, well, that held up really well. But when the opening sequence, I actually laughed a little bit because. At the time, when I saw this in the theaters way back when, I was like, wow, this is so cool. And everything just struck me as very believable. I was just very in awe by the special effects, especially, and the story. But then when I came back to it, the musical score was, you know, very steeped in its time, right? There's the sequence where they're showing the future, and they have... a machine kind of flying through the air and shooting laser beams down. And there's I think it's Kyle Reese. I can't remember. The resistance is sort of down below, and they have some of the Terminators running across this field with broken down stone and skulls and things like that. And they show a tank running over some of the skulls, and you could tell it was like stop animation. And some of that happened later in the movie as well. And I couldn't help but think of like Jason and the Argonauts, you know, with the skeleton scene where it was just very obvious that kind of effect was going on. So it was kind of neat to see some of the seams, so to speak, that I never did see back then. And yet see some scenes, like you mentioned the eye scene that was, you know, you could tell it was not his head, of course, but it still held up really well. It was a very, tense, you know, scene. So it was an interesting mix for me. You know, some stuff showing, other stuff not.
Yeah. So, I was going to say, was I the only one who when the hunter-killer flies over, had like an Aliens flashback? Because I feel like the ship design is really similar
to
the...
It is very similar to the dropship from Aliens. Yeah, and I mean, it's a James Cameron, so I suspect the same art direction. He probably uses the same people, but it looks very similar. I agree that, you know, obviously you can tell there's stop animation. That great scene when we see the Terminator without all the skin actually walking for that first time, like, it's obvious it's stop animation, but it is also super cool, because you know it's like there's an actual tangible object that they move to make this image, which we just often don't get. With CG, it's just always so removed. Like, I feel like I was saying on Twitter that CG tends to age worse than these more practical effects, precisely because the object isn't tangible. It's this thing, like, you know, I go back to look at the newer Star Wars movies, and Yoda looks ridiculous.
Yeah, he does.
Right? Because the seams are there, but you also realize, like, those seams are seams that were built into it, right? It wasn't like the limits of the technology, like they can't actually make a robotic head that looks exactly like Arnold, but they get really close and it's really creepy still. It's just always going to age poorly because it's CG and they can't go back and redo Yoda. I don't remember, how many of you have seen the Mortal Kombat movie?
The first one, yeah.
Yeah, with Reptile. The first time Reptile shows up, and he's like, it's the worst CG animation ever. When I was a kid, I thought it was the greatest thing since sliced bread. And now I look back at it and I actually laugh because it's so awful. it's worse than Terminator, than Terminator 2, which some of the effects kind of age pretty poorly. This just, it's just awful. But in any case, that's kind of my bit. But now we kind of jump to you, Brad. Because you had a thing you wanted to talk about when it came to Arnold.
Yeah, Arnold and casting a little bit. I mean, so one of the things I think about a lot in writing is that we have to get so much right. You know, like it's not just the idea, it's the execution, and it's the type of characters, and it's the tone that you use. And sometimes you have to even be topical. You have to kind of strike it a little bit in terms of the audience, and that creates buzz, you know, and then you get this, this great book that sells, you know, a million copies. And I think movies in some ways are very similar, just different disciplines to get right. So the story itself, of course, the idea, the special effects, the musical score, and then, you know, the casting. And so I was pretty aware of casting this time just because it had been a while. And I was just kind of curious the whole time as I was getting ready for the rewatch, how well it was going to hold up. And, you know, like I said, some of the special effects didn't, and I didn't really care. There's a lot that did. But the one thing that really stood out to me was Arnold himself. His presence, back then was very powerful, and it still is. You know, I watched and I'm like, wow, this is really cool. And even though he is really just mostly a blank face, you know, throughout the whole thing, he doesn't do any emoting to speak of. But he was perfect, you know, for this movie. And he had some good lines as well. It wasn't like he, didn't have any, you know, a bit of humor thrown in here and there. So he was quite good. Linda Hamilton, I liked, you know, I think she fit her role in this movie. We'll talk about it, but I like her way more in the second movie. I think a lot of people did. She was good. She played the right kind of role, and the role itself grated on me a little bit because she was the damsel being saved. And then Kyle Reese, I think was good. He stuck out to me in that I was kind of noticing his patterns of speech, I suppose. He comes from the future, but he came across as sort of a West Coast surfer, you know, kind of guy to me. So anyway, it was an interesting mix. So, you know, I think it was interesting comparing the casting and their performances in this movie versus the second movie, which I think pulled it together a little bit better.
Yeah, I mean, Arnold, I mean, this is one of his most iconic roles, and it's really hilarious because not that many years earlier, he was in one of his first major film appearances, which was, I think, Hercules in New York. I think it's the name. It's Hercules. I can't remember what the rest of the title is.
Okay.
And it's awful because he's actually required to act, but he sounds like a Terminator. So, but yet here, there's something, maybe it's just because he doesn't have a lot of dialogue and they kind of play up on the fact that he's this massive muscular monstrosity, that makes him much more menacing. Because I feel like if Arnold came stalking towards me without a shirt on and with that grimace on his face, I think that would terrify me. Because he's huge. It's a massive man. So, he is a great pick, and I think he's even better in Terminator 2, but that's kind of me. Also, I just want to say that Arnold was naked in this, and I appreciated that, so. You know, he's attractive. Is it in Terminator 2 when he goes to the bar, right? Terminator 2.
Yeah.
I love when all the women in there, like, leer at him and women who are, like, looking at him disgusted. And I love that. I love that scene because I'm like, yeah, that'd be the response. So anyway, Mike, sorry.
Yeah, on the Michael Bayne character, I actually found myself really appreciating kind of a semi-wildness to the character, like a guy who I thought the actor was doing a good job of showing him having been on the edge for a long time in the way that he snapped at people and that his responses were really not fit. Throughout a decent chunk of the film, they weren't a fit to the time he was in, and that he played his fascination and obsession with Sarah Connor actually fairly well. It wasn't something I really noticed or paid a lot of attention to when I saw the film as a kid, because I was mostly focusing on the action and Arnold. But I think that there's a solid like physical economy of movement mixed with a little bit of wildness to Bane's performance in the first one.
Yeah, he feels like a man suffering from living in a war zone for most of his life. Yeah. So, Rachel.
I actually do kind of want to defend Sarah Connor in this movie a little bit. Because I think the first time I saw the movie many moons ago, I also was like, oh god, damsel in distress. Which is very true. I mean, in many ways, Sarah Connor in the first Terminator is more of a football that's getting, you know, carried around by, and they're just trying to keep her away from the Terminator, and her only importance as a character is not even what she necessarily does herself, but the fact that she's going to have a baby, which, I mean, there could be a long discussion about James Cameron and his sort of mom obsession. But to a certain extent, this viewing, I developed a lot more sympathy for her, or empathy, because I kind of looked at it as, she's a woman in the early 80s who, you know, has a pet iguana, and the most exciting thing in her life is going out on a date on Friday night, and then there's suddenly a killing machine from the future that wants to murder her. I don't blame her for kind of being freaked out and not a badass. Because if it was me, I would be leaving a little trail of pee everywhere I went. Like, so, I mean, I feel like she has you definitely are seeing this arc in the movie where she starts out and she's kind of like getting dragged around by Kyle, and then by the end, she's trying to drag him along.
Yeah.
And make him keep moving, and then she's the one who ultimately kills the Terminator. So, I mean, that, she, like, Kyle is kind of like a character that has more agency for a lot of the movie, because he's the guy running around and shooting things and telling Sarah, come with me if you want to live. But she's actually the person who undergoes the most development throughout the film.
Yeah.
For sure.
Yeah, and that's something I think I'm going to talk about when we get to Terminator 2.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because that development is significant, because, yeah, she is a damsel in distress here, but she does have, as you say, right, Rachel, she has this massive amount of development here where she kind of has to become the role that she isn't even there yet, right? But she has to become the person that she's expected to become, even in this film, to a small degree. I mean, I love when she lifts him up and she says, you know, like, get up, soldier, we gotta go, right? She basically becomes the commander in that moment. right? She's play acting it. Like, I don't think it's actually meant like that she's actually become commander yet, but she's clearly using that in that moment to kind of spur him on. So.
Yeah. And it's interesting that you have to, for something like this, where you're telling a story across a couple of movies, you have to set a certain trajectory for the character, you know, and it's sort of reaching out, you know, towards where she's going to be. And in the next movie, it's almost reaching back a little bit, you know, and then you see all the things that came in between with really good economy.
Yes.
So, yeah, I absolutely agree that she did rise to the occasion by the end of the movie. And that was really satisfying by the end.
Yeah. I'm sorry, Mike, go ahead.
Yeah. And I feel like she's pretty street smart, even early on, in terms of the way that she handles herself and deals with crowds. So I think she's not as instantly capable as some like every man or every woman heroes that we see in other 80s action films. But I think for a kind of a quote unquote unskilled hero, she acquits herself very well in the first film.
Yeah. And I wonder too, having this conversation, if it's possible for us to think about Sarah Connor in this film without the foreknowledge of what's to come in the second film. Because
true, we've been spoiled forever.
Right, well, because there is some degree, I mean, it's too late now. I mean, and most of us have seen the second film in the science fiction community, or at least are aware of what she becomes. But it would be interesting if we could find a way to have a conversation with someone who had not seen the second film and didn't know anything about it, to see how they read the character without that foreknowledge there. But in any case, we should probably jump ahead to Rachel, who wants to talk about... it's Mike. It's Mike. Mike, we're talking to you, Mike. You want to talk about slasher flicks.
Yeah, so I saw the first film probably in the late 80s, and I was pretty young, and saw the first one and the second one pretty close together. But what I hadn't seen by that time, or even for a few years after, was many slasher films in the horror genre. And looking back and rewatching Terminator, having seen more of those films, thanks to my fiance, who's a big horror fan, I was really struck by a lot of the ways that the Terminator figure fills that kind of villain archetype of the slasher villain, where they don't talk a lot. They are mostly characterized by their overpowering strength and their determination and kind of almost inexorable movement toward killing the heroes, defeating the heroes, or achieving whatever the goal is, all the way down to the false death that you see very frequently in slasher films, where the heroine, the final girl, rises up and defeats the monster, but then they come back again for one more go, either to kill the last girl or to like kill one more person or to need to be killed again. And we definitely see that in the Terminator films, as a franchise, at least in the first two, is very marked. Where, you know, to go into spoiler land for folks who haven't seen it, at the end, you know, Reese with the pipe bomb blowing the Terminator, like the already once sort of dead Terminator, into pieces, and yet it keeps coming, so that you have that that unrelenting aspect to it, which I can really closely align aesthetically with the slasher monsters. So it's like a pursuit horror film with a lot of thriller structure, and I think it comes off to me more like an action film because you have Reese as a character who's at least able to operate in the same theater that the Terminator is, even if he's totally outclassed. You know, this is a movie where action is a viable response, even if it's not one that's sufficient to defeat the monster. So that it was really cool to reinterpret the film through that lens this time.
Interesting. Brad, you want to jump in?
Yeah, well, I completely agree now that you say it, and I'm annoyed that I didn't see this before. I'm not really a big horror fan, so maybe that's why. But yeah, it makes complete sense, and it's interesting to me that it is pretty formulaic, but it absolutely works. I mean, I watched it again, and I was still on the edge of my seat, so to speak, as I was watching it, you know, seeing it just nonstop, just coming, even though I knew what was coming. So it's a formula that works, you know, for sure. So it was interesting to see this kind of mashup almost with sci-fi.
And it's kind of funny. I think it's maybe just because I've seen a lot more zombie movies than slasher movies, but I actually kept kept thinking zombie just in this, like, the sense of the slow walking zombie that it will just walk you down and it will not ever stop until it eats your brain. So that was kind of, but definitely I get that slasher flick thing too. I think it's just that I've watched way more zombie movies.
Yeah, and I think the thing that sets it apart maybe a little bit is that, you know, we know that it's a cybernetic android and that it's very good at what it does. It's shown us that, and it's more mindful maybe than I would think a lot of those other sort of creatures or characters are in those types of movies. And that sort of makes it a little bit more, I don't know, creepy or tense, you know, as you're watching it.
Yeah, because the smarter the hunter monster is, the scarier they are. You know, the idea that the Terminator can move through some social situations and can turn some like societal aspects to its use makes it that more terrifying of a predator. You know, because the Terminator is an infiltration monster, right?
And speaking of predators. I think that's why Predator works so well too.
Yeah.
Because it was very smart. It was high tech. You know, those people were outgunned from the beginning, and yet Arnold pulls it out at the end.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, okay. Well, why don't we jump to you, Rachel?
Okay. So what I mostly wanted to talk about was not really in the sense of the special effects, but kind of the way technology was represented in this film as, if nothing else, very much a threat. But what I also found interesting was that a lot of the designs, particularly like that giant tank thing with the guns, and then, you know, a lot of that is not necessarily the most efficient form a people-killing robot could take if it was probably designed by other robots. Though I will note that the hunter-killers, drone warfare, that's not worrying at all, is it?
No, but, it's not.
Yeah, no, not at all. But there's this sort of sense about, you know, obviously technology being this scary thing and it becoming even more threatening as it becomes less obviously machine-like, if that makes sense. That's all I was thinking about with that, because, you know, this movie I was mostly just like, hey, it's Arnold and he's got a butt.
Mike?
Yeah, and kind of to what you said at the end there, that as the machines are more or less human, that kind of changes how we react to them. And I definitely think that if it had just been a humanoid robot the whole time, one, a lot of the plot would have had to change, but two, I don't think a lot of us, myself included, would have reacted as viscerally, because there's that kind of aversion of the idea of the abjection, the thing that is close enough to you that it can drag you into its kind of its aura, like Juliana Kristeva, the abject. I'm sure Sean can speak to this as well some, that because the monster here is closer to humanity and has aspects of humanity in terms of presentation, that makes it a different kind of scary monster versus a little bit more of an abstracted or estranged flying drone or like laser tank.
Well, and there's that whole thing about when the Terminator is at his absolutely scariest is when all of the flesh gets burnt away and you get this machine that has the semblance of a human, where it was like, you know, hiding under a human skin. And there's something about that that's really, like, very oogie, and it also makes me think about that the degloving scene in Terminator 2, which was very oogie.
Yeah,
because for me, actually, the Terminators are at their scariest when, like, they're missing the eye, where they mostly look human, but they are clearly not. Like, and then we can get to this more in T2, but yeah, in the first one, where that one robot eye that they focus on is really the big scare shot for me in terms of like Uncanny Valley abjection.
Mm.
So like this idea of the Uncanny Valley, you know, the Terminator becomes more terrifying the less human it looks, which I think very much aligns with the way in which we treat human beings who do commit horrible acts. We attempt to dehumanize them because we don't want to admit that this is part of the human condition. Where in this film, I think what we end up having is that Arnold, right, he's running around shooting rampantly, right? He's shooting police cars and people, and he's killing people indiscriminately, but he's human. But the moment he ceases to be that, the further he gets away from being actually human, the more horrifying he is, precisely because now we can actually see him as the monster for what he really is, versus the kind of horror of the normal human subject. At least that's how I kind of look at it, but maybe I'm full of nonsense. Brad, what do you think?
I totally agree with that. That's what I was going to say, was at the very end when it was all the flesh had been stripped away, it was just a robot in essence, and it had been blown up by that pipe bomb Rachel mentioned, and it was sort of half of a robot at that point. And so it was kind of crawling along at the end. You know, that was the creepiest moment for me. And I think it goes, you know, talking about zombie movies a little bit, I think the reason that zombie movies work so well is not only because they're after you and, you know, there's you're sort of alone-ish, even if you're with a group of people. It's because you see that a human has devolved into this thing, right? And so you think it can happen to me, and you think about that loss. And when you see the Terminator being broken down and stripped away, it has lost any semblance of humanity it once had. But we did see it that way, you know, at one point. And so it just... It kind of reminds me of that sort of feeling of, you know, losing yourself, losing your humanity, or other people you love having the same thing happen to them.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, okay, so let's just grade this sucker. On the American school system grade, so that means you have to grade inflate by 2 grades. So we'll start with you, Brad. How would you grade this film?
So my younger self, when I first saw it, I would have given it an A+. And at this point I have to go A- just because of the change and, you know, seeing it for what it is now that, the seams in the special effects and that sort of thing.
Okay. All right. Rachel?
My gut instinct is a B+. So that's what I'm going with, because I'm like Stephen Colbert. I listen to my gut.
Okay. All right. Mike.
Yeah, I'm going to go with a B+ as well. I think, you know, as a kid, I totally liked it. But even then, I know I like T2 more.
Yeah.
Well, I give it an A-, because I think it's a superb film. And take that. So, perfect. All right, well, why don't we now jump over to Terminator 2, the tentatively or appropriately titled Judgment Day, which ironically never actually occurs in the movie. Very strange.
It does in a kind of fever dream.
Sure, but I don't know. But anyway.
I would argue that Judgment Day did occur, but in a different form than, you know, the literal judgment.
I knew that was
going to
happen. I knew someone was going to be all like, I'm going to be pretentious film critic, Rachel. It just came in the form of a metaphor. Yeah, that's my pretentious movie critic voice. That's a ridiculous sound. But why don't we take you, Rachel, you get to describe this movie to us.
Okay, so this movie is a direct sequel to the first movie, and in the opening voiceover, we get informed by Sarah Connor that actually Kyle was wrong. Skynet didn't send one Terminator back, it sent 2 Terminators back, and one of them was sent to kill Sarah, and one of them was sent to kill John when he was 10 years old. And then... In a very clever ploy, the voiceover continues, but the Resistance was able to send back one person, a lone hero again. And it's just a matter of who gets to John first. Yeah, I'll get to talk about that more later. So then it's the T-800 versus the T-1000 trying to get to John first, and then protecting John, and then rescuing Sarah Connor, and then them... deciding to blow up Cyberdyne systems because there is some serious timey-wimey bullshit happening, where, like, the reason that Skynet is going to get invented is because the Terminator came back and left, like, part of his chip there, and they're basing all this technology off of that, and then Skynet gets invented, and it's one big giant circle of timey-wimey-ness. And so, oh dear. And so Sarah Connor and John and the Terminator team up with the scientist who would have, if time were going to be a giant circle, caused the end of the world, and they blow up the thing, and the movie ends with them kind of riding down the road and being like, hey, the future is now unwritten, we don't know where we're going, but hopefully it's not into a global nuclear war.
Dyson, who is like a superhero in this.
Oh, he is so cool.
Isn't he? Ah, he saves people's lives and everything. It's wonderful. Yeah, sad that he dies, though.
So, Mike had a hand, because I'm sure I botched that summary terribly, but it's kind of like a lot of shit gets blown up and people get shot, and I'm happy.
My understanding and recollection with the Terminator franchise was that it was always a many timelines theory, where every time somebody travels back in time, the next time somebody travels back in time, it's from the timeline that's created by that first person. So that the timeline of the future in T2 that the Terminators come back from is not the future that it was when they came back from the future in the first one.
No, it's very similar, but there are differences that aren't really explained to us much.
So that's my understanding of why that Cyberdyne thing is different. So that it isn't actually a bootstrap paradox. It's that the future, every time Skynet or the humans send somebody back, is always different.
Right, and that's said that in the first Terminator movie, when Reese actually gives her that speech from her son, where he basically says that time isn't fixed, or the future isn't fixed. The idea being that we can make changes and change what is to come. It just happens that in every Terminator movie, no matter what they do, Judgment Day still happens. It just is different. Like, so by the time we get to Terminator 3, right, it's not Cyberdyne that is the responsible agent, it's actually the U.S. military, and things go to hell in a handbasket. So, like, certain events seem like, as the Doctor would say, they may be fixed points in history. They just fixed in the sense that when they happen in history are not fixed.
Yeah.
If that makes sense. A fixed point that can move.
Yeah, yeah. It's like a waypoint.
Right, so like Judgment Day has to occur. That doesn't appear. I haven't seen Terminator Genesis, so I have no idea if it changes this. But it must occur, but that doesn't necessarily have to occur in the year in which it was originally meant to occur.
Okay, so that's the timey-wimey stuff.
Yeah, timey-wimey. So the first thing I want to talk about is the thing that folks are expecting us to talk about, which is Sarah Connor. Because in Terminator 2, she is the more iconic version of Sarah Connor we have come to expect. Linda Hamilton bulks up a bit and basically becomes a super badass in a way that I think hasn't been seen since. The closest badass to her would have been Ripley.
Rita?
Rita? Who's Rita?
In All You Need Is Kill.
Okay.
Emily Blunt and her arms.
Stop contradicting me. Just let me say things that are wrong, and just let me have these. I don't have much in life, Rachel.
Well, I'm just saying she's obviously in the tradition of Sarah Connor because look at them arms.
Yeah, that's fair. Okay. Well, in any case, I retract the stupidity that I said. But what I want to talk about with her is actually in connection with the previous film. So in the first film, she does begin as a damsel in distress, as we kind of talked about. She develops somewhat. I mean, she has significant development, but she isn't quite the Sarah Connor she will become in Terminator 2. But in Terminator 2, she is the, like, inches away from the end of the world Sarah Connor. I mean, she's bulked up. She's been running around the world. By the time we get to the movie, of course, she's been captured and locked up in a mental institution, but she is this aggressive, violent person who is desperate to stop what is to come. And her character is amazing because of how she has changed just so drastically between these two films. And even changes here, perhaps not as dramatically, I think. I think the most dramatic characterization here is actually Arnold's Terminator, who goes from being automaton machine to almost being a feeling machine, but not quite. But for her, her development is actually to take away some of the roughness, right, that she learns from her son, right? She's basically like the Terminator, kill anything that's going to bring about Judgment Day, including Dyson. But that turns out to be not the right path for her, and it's the one that her son kind of leads her away from, that she kind of pulls back and finds her, as it were, kind of finds part of her humanity, as Arnold's character, the Terminator, also is finding his humanity. And it's an interesting thing that she even says, right, when she's watching John interact with the Terminator, where she says that, you know, maybe this is actually the thing that could save us, is that if we can find a way to change our own path by making us more human. I mean, it's basically what she's implying. It just so happens we're finding your humanity through machines, which is also the very thing that's going to destroy us. There's this like really weird irony. And obviously Sarah Connor in this movie is just amazing. I mean, Linda Hamilton I don't know how she did it, but she's simply astonishing in this film. I mean, it's as iconic as Ripley, right? With Sigourney Weaver in Aliens. It's an amazing performance, and even seeing the extended edition, there's just so much meat for her character. She's complex, even as she is violent and seemingly one-directional. But that's kind of what I wanted to say, and I suspect folks will have other things to kind of raise here.
Can I spin off of that a little bit?
Sure.
On mine. It's related so closely to what I was going to talk about, and I have to thank Rachel for giving, you know, me the prompt for this, which is talking a little bit about the family unit that forms. So in the beginning, we see the two Terminators. We don't know. Well, we see a Terminator who is Arnold, and we see another man come across. And so in the beginning, we don't know that he's another Terminator, and we find that out later. And that's a great twist. Edward Furlong, who plays young John Connor, first comes across Arnold Schwarzenegger, the T-800, and, you know, he's heard stories about the Terminator, and he didn't believe it, you know, and then he actually gets caught right between Arnold and the T-1000, you know, and the two start firing right away. And then he kind of realizes, he's in deep shit and he has to run. But that's the first glimmer of understanding that his mother was right. and then, you know, that he was wrong all along for doubting her, and that she isn't crazy. And so that the connection starts to form between John Connor and the Terminator, because he's saved by the Terminator. And he starts to hear the backstory that he was programmed to come back and save him. And then they go to save Sarah Connor, who's in an institution, being questioned by some of the same people from the first movie that don't believe her at all about the Terminator. And so she's on her way to breaking herself out. And I have to call out this scene. It's my favorite scene in the movie, where she is running down the hallway and the elevator opens up, and I can't remember if she sees John first, but then she sees the Terminator, and she like stops, and her feet sort of screech on the linoleum floor, and
she sees the Terminator first, okay.
That was just great. I mean, we see how much she's changed already, you know, so we already know how serious she is, and we know what she went through, and nobody else believes her, and then she sees her greatest fear, you know, showing up again. And it was just a great scene. But then as the movie moves along, you know, she, of course, is very shocked, you know, by the appearance, but then has a, you know, very difficult time trusting John and what he's saying. You know, and so there's sort of a two-way trust issue going on. He, the young John Connor, didn't believe her. She doesn't believe him now. They have to come to understand each other. They have to understand the Terminator. And so they do form a little family unit. So that was very interesting to see. And I'm as you were talking about Sarah Connor, and we see her in the first movie and how she grows, Well, in this movie, John Connor has to grow. He has to become the person he's going to become, right? In the eventual resistance, you know, against the rise of the robots. And so he goes through a similar path as well, almost paralleling what she went through, even though he's younger and the path is different. He still grows up, and we see a lot of this. He starts to assert himself. He is not just led around by his mother. You know, he is also a leader at some point because he has a say in how things are going to go. And how, as you mentioned, Sean, they can't be completely inhuman in their quest to save humanity.
Yeah. So a lot in here. I'm so grateful to have seen Terminator 2 when I was pretty young, because I think it was one of a number of things that helped me get on board with women can be equal protagonists and action heroes earlier than I might have without that kind of media. And I think it's really cool. Yeah. That in this, I didn't notice as much when I was a kid, again, because I tended to round out off the weaker sides, is being able to see a character as awesome and dynamic and kind of plot driving as Sarah Connor be able to be weak and despair in moments, and to have that not invalidate the moments where she's strong and where she is pushing the plot forward and nothing can get in her way, that she gets to be all of those things, and she gets to be a mother, and she gets to change her mind.
Yes.
Yeah, and true.
Kind of, I mean, what for me, like, when I was younger, my favorite scene was her escaping the hospital, just because, I mean, my God, like, the planning, and then she beats up the guy who was creepy at her, and the thing with the Drano, and all that was really cool. But on this rewatching of it, my favorite scene actually turned out being when she went to Dyson's house to kill him. And we see that kind of where she has that breakdown where she's so focused on what needs to happen, and then she's finally faced with the realization that I think almost that she has become the thing that she most fears. She's become like the Terminator, because she's about to go in there and, you know, take away a kid's father. Yeah. In front of him and his, you know, the kid and his wife.
Yeah.
Or, I mean, the kid and Dyson's wife. And that's when you see her just crack. And it was just remarkable.
And there's this great triangulation of characterization.
Sure.
Everyone's been touching on just that the introduction of the T2 Arnold Terminator completely rewrites the relationship between John and Sarah. And then throughout that film, the three of them are threading through each other and influencing each other and reacting to each other in a way that really stuck with me, just from a kind of storytelling standpoint, to think about relationship triangles beyond, above and perhaps as stronger or more dynamic than just two-way relationships, because of how they can thread in and push and pull on each other in really cool ways. And it's something I see in like tabletop RPGs. I first was introduced to the idea of the relationship map, and thinking about T2 and the leads in that frame, I think, is really cool.
Yeah, and I think it's interesting that it's you know, on this family aspect that we have what should be the nuclear family, but it's not.
Right.
Because John is teaching Arnold as much as, well, I mean, really, he's the one teaching everyone. In a strange way, he's not actually, I mean, he's learned from his mother previously, right? Sarah Connor has taught him how to survive and get him all these skills, but it's him teaching both the Terminator and his mother more or less how to be human, which isn't what we would typically get, and it's completely different from the first Terminator movie, where basically what we have is a more traditional kind of nuclear family. Minus the fact that, well, I guess the child technically already exists because of timey-wimey, whatever. So I did find that really an interesting aspect of the family part, because of that relationship. It's also, I think, brings us some of the most joyous moments in cinema. I mean, the part where John Connor tries to teach Arnold how to smile.
Oh my God.
Yeah.
And that was an added scene. That was not in the original.
Yeah, it's I didn't amazing. Remember it.
Yeah, it's in the one of the extended editions. It's just an amazing scene where he's trying to teach him like how you need to learn how to be like, you know, to be cool essentially. Mm-hmm. And he's like, "Look at that kid. You know, look at how he's smiling." And the, you know, the robot has to analyze it to figure out how to do the facial maneuvers. And then he gives this just massive grin, smile, monstrosity, which is completely artificial and awkward. And Arno pulls it off in a way that, which is weird because I'm sure that's just his smile, but it just looks not real on his face. It is wonderful and it is charming. And it also, it does something to the Terminators. Or at least to Arnold's Terminator that we've come to expect now, which is this very personable, lovable Terminator, despite the fact that he is a violent killing machine. He's also capable of heart, as it were, versus the other Terminator played by, Robert Patrick, who is cold, murderous, apparently really freaking hates dogs. Yeah, so, Brad, you wanted to jump in.
Yeah, I mean, as we're talking about, you said some of the best, you know, scenes in cinema, and I agree. And as I'm thinking about, like, the one you mentioned with the smile, and Rachel, as you're talking about the one with Sarah going to Dyson's place to, you know, to murder him, essentially, and, it, you know, she changes her mind throughout that episode. The most interesting things to me, I think, whether it's from movies or fiction, is when characters are changing. And those are some of those scenes where they're going through a transformation of some sort. And it requires that we know that beforehand. And it requires that we sort of see the new trajectory that they're going on. But those are very emotional moments, you know, to go through, even though, you know, we're dealing with Terminator in one case. You know, but we feel that stuff, you know, so it's very affecting, mm-hmm. when it actually happens legitimately, you know, with real emotions. And in this movie, it did.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, I guess since we, you know, Brad and I have kind of gone through ours in a way, but I think there's also a thread here that kind of ties to what Rachel was talking about, and I think you mentioned a little bit of it, but do you want to kind of go through your point about basically the change in the plot twist, as it were, which gets ruined for you if you watch the trailer?
Yeah, I mean, that's actually, I found an article about this as I was just, you know, Googling some stuff earlier, and they mention, like, if you went into the movie without ever having seen any of the trailers or, you know, the publicity campaign stuff, and you'd seen Terminator 1, you go into T2, and your default assumption is going to end up being that the T-800 is the evil Terminator that's going to kill John, and that the kind of scary, super-focused guy looks like a human, because there is no indication that he's not human until Arnold finally shoots him. So, I mean, James Cameron cut this thing beautifully and structured it beautifully, and about the only thing that is a little bit off about it are the musical cues. But if you went into this blind, you'd be sitting there going, "Oh shit, oh god, John, stay the hell away from the T-800, he's going to kill you." And it turns out that suddenly there's like this immediate switch as soon as the two Terminators meet, and you realize that they're both robots and Arnold is the good guy this time. And it got completely ruined by the PR campaign. I actually, God, when did this movie come out?
91 or 92?
Yeah. I was actually still too young to see this movie when it was out in theaters, because I was like 11, and my parents did not let me see it. So I didn't see it until much later, and when I saw it, I hadn't seen the trailers or anything like that. So my memory of the first time watching this movie is I was like shitting myself over, "Oh my god, Arnold Schwarzenegger is evil," and then he wasn't, and I was just like, "Holy shit." So, I mean, and there's a lot of really kind of cool editing, you know, like if you want to get really into cinematography, there's a lot of really cool stuff that Cameron did in this film. But, yeah, I mean, this, I, I thought it was interesting to see the extended version. Like, so if you go and rent it off Google Play, it'll be this 2.5 hour long version, which, you know, holy crap. There's a lot of the scenes added, like the one Sean mentioned with the Terminator learning to smile, are really interesting. But it does kind of bloat the movie a little, because it was originally a very tightly edited movie where it had, you know, the plot coherence was good, even though we lost a lot of the character moments, which is something that doesn't always happen when they trim movies down.
Yeah, I actually prefer the extended cut.
Well, it's weird. Like, this is Cameron seems to really like, James Cameron seems to like doing these super extended versions of his movies. Like, you think, you know, the really extended version of Aliens, The Abyss. There's actually two different cuts of The Abyss, and I think I tend to think that, like, the director's cut of The Abyss is actually also superior, just because the aliens make some fucking sense in that one.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know if there's an extended cut of Avatar, but I really hope not, because that was already a 12-hour movie. But in here, I mean, sometimes I think extended cuts don't actually make the movie better. Some of the Lord of the Rings movies, right, the extended cuts are like a half hour longer, but they're not necessarily stronger movies for it. This one, I think, is stronger because of the characterization that comes in. Because I think, you know, this is an action movie, but I think what gives it its heart is actually all the detailed attention to the development of the relationship between John Connor and the Terminator, or between him and his mother. And if you cut some of these excess scenes out, you lose that in a way that I think really matters. But maybe that's just me. I'm sure some people just don't care about extended cuts, but I think it is a stronger film with the extra scenes. Rachel, I would just agree with you that the exact thing you're talking about. I mean, I saw this movie cold when I was younger, but this is the kind of thing I hate with trailers, when they basically just tell you the story.
Yeah.
You know, if there's a twist, you can't tell me the damn twist.
Right.
Like, yeah. There was a huge, blow up along this line with the second How to Train Your Dragon film.
What
did they give away?
So this will be a spoiler for folks who've seen the first but not the second How to Train Your Dragon. They put the revelation that the kind of dragon rider is Hiccup's mother in one of the first trailers.
That's right. Yeah.
And the like creative team was not informed, and they flipped out. Because that's a huge reveal.
Yeah. Right. You know, that wouldn't have been a problem if it was revealed in, like, the first 10 minutes.
No, but it's, like, 40 minutes in or so.
It's, like, the halfway mark is when they reveal that. And, like, that's kind of the whole point of those first 40 minutes is trying to figure that out. Right. But they constantly do this. They do this garbage. And I hate trailers for this reason. Like, I will not watch any other Star Wars trailer. Because
I'm not going to either anymore. Yeah.
Every time they add some new thing. Like, the first one with the weird lightsaber was enough. Right? Like, I got, like, little things to entice me. I'm going to go see the movie. I don't want to have anything ruined. I don't want to know anything. I'm not even reading the blog post where people are analyzing the images frame by frame, because I don't want to know. Because trailers do this constantly. They just ruin everything. And it pisses me off. So, I would imagine Rachel being angry if you had seen the trailer before seeing this movie. Because,
Well, I mean, you might... The kind of funny thing is, I've actually never been spoiler phobic, and I've never really, I don't even feel like that would have ruined the experience for me, but I'm kind of like, I'm always the person when someone's like, oh well, this thing, but you know, spoilers, I'll just be like, oh, just tell me, because if I'm gonna watch it, I'm gonna watch it, and if I'm not gonna anyway, so tell me, I'd rather know.
Fair enough. Brad?
I was just gonna talk just a touch on the two different Terminators. You know, we talked about, Rachel talked about the, you know, the switch, the reveal, that the T-1000 is the enemy, in fact, and the T-800 is the ally. But we were talking, you know, about the previous movie, about how we have this, you know, horror-esque kind of angle to Arnold. And in this movie, it has a lot of that same stuff. But it also reminds me a little bit of like kaiju films, or maybe even like wuxia films that show like the enemy and maybe even the hero sometimes as gaining more powers. You like reveal more things as it goes along. And the T-1000, you don't know much about them But pretty early on, we see that it's liquid metal. It can kind of take different shapes. It can look like other things. It can turn its hands into swords or hooks. It can take the voice of other people. So it has all these interesting abilities that are sort of doled out, you know, over time, and just makes it very interesting. And the landscape changes. Your understanding of the enemy changes as the movie moves along. Whereas in the first film, that it happened to a degree in that, you know, as we said, Arnold sort of changes to become inhuman, but he's not sort of gaining powers. So this is kind of a flip of the script a little bit in this movie, which made it more interesting.
Interesting. Okay. Does anyone else want to jump in there? Show we throw one to Mike, I think.
Sure. So I'm going to take a little bit of a kind of broader cultural studies view on the film. And it's mostly going to be pretty personal, because being a 1983 kid in the U.S., I got the tail end of Cold War millennialism, of like mutually assured destruction of threads of popular culture being like, oh yeah, of course the world's going to end. Yeah, this is just how it's going to be. And then not just a few years later, then kind of and around the same time the Soviet Union is collapsing and the Cold War is kind of disentangling, I saw this rise of kind of technological millennialism, where you had the technophobic or the kind of ambiguous technophobic, technophilic films of the 80s and into the 90s with cyberpunk, and definitely in a big way with Terminator 2, where the Terminator is, or the robots are the thing that we have to fight against, but there's also a robot that we can turn to our benefit, and that relationship is that there's a tension there, and that kind of throughout my life in terms of the speculative fiction and the cultural framing of the narrative of what life is going to be like. And I think this is something that's fairly common for kind of older millennials or people who are Gen Y, as I heard it called a while back, is that there's always some form of millennialism. And I wanted to mark the way that T2 for me fit into that like 1991, the early 90s millennialism of like a deep ambivalence about technology, and kind of some early speculative representations of the singularity, where robots, you're going to create robots, and that's going to be a huge status quo change for us. So I don't know what other folks, if they had thoughts about that kind of framing of this in terms of cultural history.
Interesting.
Well, I definitely got some of that Cold War feel, because we were shown through like the... It wasn't really a flashback sequence. It was Sarah constantly dreaming, right, of the coming disaster, and that those kinds of images were, constantly given to, to me, and as I was growing up, I kind of hit the tail end of that type of thing in the, I was too young in the late 60s, but into the 70s that carried over, and that a lot of that, that scare, the enemy sort of feeling was certainly in American culture strongly at that time. So yeah, I got some resonance there from that.
Well, I do think it's interesting that that we're bringing up the Cold War reference, given that by 1991, it's over. I mean, with the exception of things collapsing still and the kind of aftermath of it, but it's 1989, that's the signal of the official collapse. And this film is coming in a decade that follows one of the most apocalyptic decades in terms of cinema. I mean, if you go through all the post-apocalyptic or nuclear war scare films in the 80s, I mean, they're all over the place, and they're some of the most gruesome, horrible visions. I mean, The Day After, for example, nuclear war comes, we all nuke each other, and everyone's going to die, but we follow for at least an hour of the film the people that have survived the initial blasting, as they slowly deteriorate and are being fed lies by the government about how we can plant crops and we can live and it's going to be okay, while their teeth are falling out and their hair is falling out and they're all dying of horrible disease. It's a story that doesn't have a happy ending. Whereas here now, that Cold War referent is gone. And I think it's important that referent is gone because now the nuclear threat isn't it's not that the nuclear threat has disappeared. It's that it's not the enemy that was there prior. It's now this other enemy. I mean, it's an enemy that's in 1984. It's just kind of not really discussed. Here we actually see it. We have that kind of visceral imagery of it occurring. But it is something that science fiction, I think, does after the fall of the Cold War, is that nuclear war now has to have place elsewhere. So it's going to be other nations in some cases. Or in this case, it's going to be our own creations doing it to us. And one could make the argument that the Terminator movies are basically extended allegories of nuclear self-destruction. And there's that line, I think it's in Terminator 2, where one of the characters says, right, that we're, oh, it's Arnold. It's Arnold who says that, humans are destined to bring about their own destruction. And that's kind of, that's the nuclear fear in general, the idea that we would build weapons that would destroy us, that would end civilization because we can't control it, but robots take it to that farther extent because they're artificial, they're intelligent, and it's the creation turning upon us. It's not our children, it's the fully created beings who reject our tutelage, as it were, and decide for themselves. It's just without the Cold War referent anymore, which I find interesting. But yeah, so that's kind of what I wanted to say about that.
As you were talking, I was thinking about like how, the story, I don't know how much of it had been written. I think, didn't he have Terminator 1 and 2 figured out by the time the first movie had come out?
I mean, I suspect he had this written well before 1991.
Right.
I mean, that's likely true, yeah.
And he was born in 54, you know, so he was a child of that period too. So, you know, a lot of that I think is probably coming from those feelings. I'm not even sure that's where it is coming from, but you know, you could certainly see that, you know, being a child that grew up in the 60s.
Yeah, and I think that if, you know, we'd need to go to I'm talking as now the academic, but if we were going to actually do that kind of analysis, we need the biographical material, you know, his actual production notes of when he was writing the script. Because from a strictly cultural analysis, this placement, right, it's 1991 and it's outside of that period. It's actually in what some academics refer to as the long 90s, which is this period between 1989 and 2001, where the U.S. has basically won, right? Neoliberalism has won. I'm being really, academic about it. And yet it's this period of immense transition because now you don't have an enemy that's defined. And so all of our horror stories of the end of the world, you can't make Red Dawn in 1991. It doesn't make sense. You can make it in the early 1980s.
You can remake it in the last couple of years.
Well, but when they remade it, part of what made that film quite dumb, in my opinion, is it made no sense, right?
Well,
when we're talking in the early 1980s, they make Red Dawn and it's Cuba and I can't remember what other Latin country and Russia, right? Soviet Russia, all involved in the invasion of the United States. Those make sense in the 1980s because that's the actual fears, like we'd have a war with Russia or the Soviet Union. Whereas in, was it like 2012 or whatever year they made the enemy North Korea. And the reason why they made it North Korea is they couldn't make it China, which is, you know, not that they're likely to invade us anytime soon, but of the major powers in the world, they're the most likely at this point to invade. But they can't do that because then they can't sell the movie in China.
They made it
North Korea, who everyone hates, but who has the capabilities of a goldfish when it comes to invading other countries. I mean, so, they could invade South Korea maybe, but they're not going to. How are they going to get here? How's that going to even happen?
Could I actually say something that I did want to say about
Cold
War thing? I mean, you will notice that in the movie, when the Terminator is describing Judgment Day and he says, "Yeah, we get, you know, it's this nuclear war where we get bombed by Russia," John even points out, "Aren't they our friends now?" And the answer is, well, yeah, but Skynet launches a strike against them knowing that they will still retaliate. And one thing to consider is, particularly back in 91, yeah, the Cold War was over, but there's still massive, you know, even today, there's still massive stockpiles of nuclear weapons and ICBMs in existence in the United States and Russia. And I think it was it last year where there was a where Obama got through another treaty for further nuclear disarmament with Russia, and people were screaming bloody murder about the U.S. wanting to reduce its nuclear stockpile so that we can only blow up the world like 3 times over instead of 7 times over.
It's just not enough.
So, I mean, I think part of it might just be that, you know, obviously when he came up with the idea of this nuclear war, it was in the 80s, and that was when the Cold War was still going on. So he had to kind of stick with it, you know, as he continued on. But I also would like to think there might have even been like that cautionary note in there about, yeah, supposedly we're friends still, but then why do we still have this capability that where we could turn the surface of the Earth into radioactive glass? Why are these nuclear weapons still around?
Yeah, I mean, it goes back to that thing that the Terminator says, right? We're prone to our own destruction, right?
Yeah.
We could all be friends, but if Skynet launches nukes at Russia, right, Russia's natural response is to retaliate. Because that's the human condition, right? It's meet violence with more violence, right? That we have this whole century where we keep saying this will be the last war, right? We're not going to keep fighting. We're done. We're going to last war, last big world war. And then we keep having them and keep having all of these incursions and violence and death and destruction. So I think that's actually what's at heart there is, you know, yeah, the Cold War is over. And yeah, obviously that like there's that hangover of it. But the real concern was never the Cold War. It was always that human compulsion to destroy itself, which Skynet's going to take advantage of, at least according to the Terminator, which is a horrifying prospect. And it's something that is very different. Well, it does appear in science fiction earlier. There's a great film called Colossus, The Forbin Project, which some people have seen. Mike, have you seen that one?
I have not.
Oh, my God. You got to see that movie. It's great. The basic premise is the United States builds a supercomputer which is capable of basically analyzing international situations and responding instantaneously with nuclear attack. The idea being that this is the actual like nuclear bomb to other people's tank, right? So it's the ultimate solution to stop all war. Well, it turns out that Russia, the Soviet Union, is doing the same thing. And the two AIs decide to speak to each other and realize that human beings are completely nuts and in fact need to be controlled for their own salvation and then take over because they basically get control of all the nuclear weapons in the entire world. And fascism follows very swiftly after. It's a very interesting film. Almost nobody's seen.
Huh.
But it's the Cold War, but it's like without, it's not nuclear weapons that kills. It's the weapon we create after nuclear weapons that kills us.
Right.
Or in this case, doesn't kill us, just wipes out some of us and keeps the rest of us under wraps. So, yeah. Well, we babbled a lot. So, good job, guys.
Woo!
I think we've gone through everybody's main points on Terminator, so I think it'd be a good time for us to grade this sucker. So, we jump to you, Brad. Will you grade Terminator 2 Judgment Day?
Yeah, I give it a solid A. I thought it was very good.
Solid A for you, Rachel?
I too give it a solid A. This is right up there with Aliens as one of my favorite go-to action happy movies. I mean, it's not like a happy movie, but it makes me happy because it's a fun movie to watch.
It's sad. It ends very sad.
Yeah, but you just stop it before then when you're like, yay, the T-1000 is dead! I'm gonna go make myself a sandwich.
Did anyone cry the first time that they saw the Terminator kill himself at the end?
Oh, hell yeah. I was like sitting next to my mom on the couch weeping, and my mom just like hands me the box of tissues.
So sad. Mike, what about you?
I concur with a solid A. I think I liked the original cut a little bit better than the extended one, which I thought dragged just a little bit in the middle, even though it gained some character moments. But I'm going to go off of the original version that I remember seeing again and again.
Well, Mike, you are wrong, but that's okay. I still love you.
That just means that it's a recording, a day we record a podcast that ends in Y, so it's all good.
And I'll also give it what is a new grade for us, which is solid A. So it's a great film, and I still have a fondness for it over the original term. And I think just because of the characterization. So,
yeah, ditto.
And on that front, we should take a moment to point out that some folks on this podcast have like book things that came out or are out already. I think both of you actually have them out already. Brad, for example, has a new book out. I believe the title is 12 Kings of Sharakai.
Yep. 12 Kings in Sharakai.
In Sharakai, actually, excuse me.
Yeah, that's a bit of a nod to Roger Zelazny for Nine Princes in Amber.
Mm-hmm. Sweet. You want to tell us a little bit about it?
Yeah. So it's epic fantasy, and it's playing off of kind of the Arabian Nights or 1001 Nights, that milieu, but it's more akin to A Song of Ice and Fire than it is those types of tales. It's definitely solid in the epic fantasy world. And I was happy to do this series on the Terminator because the main character is a female pit fighter that we learn early on in the book has lost her mother when she was young. And she loses her to the 12 kings of the city who rule the desert with an iron fist. And she vowed revenge, but hasn't really been able to do anything about it until one fateful night when she goes out on a night forbidden to the citizens of the city. And one of these strange creatures that comes and takes tribute, takes lives from the city. Comes and gives her a kiss. And that starts off a whole chain of events that leads back to her mother and what her mother was doing, and leads to her quest to hopefully do something about the kings and avenge her mother.
Fascinating. Just a quick question, and then we kind of have to move on because I can't interview you now. but I mean, obviously this isn't, you said, right, and it's even on your page, right, it's an influence by the Arabian Nights. And I'm curious, did you find that a particularly difficult, region to kind of borrow from? Or period of history, as it were?
Well, I guess not so much because, I had written a previous trilogy, which was very Russian inspired. It was a lot of the culture was based off Muscovite Russia and Ottoman Turkey. But in the third book, I started to explore a Persian-esque culture in a desert, a vast desert. And we didn't spend a ton of time there, but that was sort of my first, you know, whetting of that appetite. I knew I was heading towards, you know, this series. So I kind of had some of that already under my belt. And so I did expand on it. I looked a bit more into like Bedouin culture because there are a number of tribes around the city that constantly wander, and they were the ones that settled the city, and actually the settling of the city versus the inclination of these tribes to constantly wander is one of the great points of strife in the desert. It was a fairly, you know, fairly easy jumping off from the previous books, but I expanded upon it and looked at different angles of those cultures that I enjoyed.
Cool. Well, folks should go check that out because it is currently out.
It is.
Which means you have to buy it now.
Yeah, and for those outside of the U.S., it's called 12 Kings. They dropped the In Sharakai.
Right, and two very different covers. So yeah, as per usual, yeah, when you go to the other parts of the world. Right. And it's available basically everywhere. There are links on his website at quillings.com. So you can go there and go to a little book section. You'll find it there. You can basically get it in any format you want. I think they will also send it via smoke signal.
They will. Yes, they've just organized that. Yep.
Yeah, it takes a long time. You may be reading that book for the next 12 years, but
yeah,
but so be it. But and now we'll jump to you, Mike, because you have, I believe, Hexomancy, which is the latest Reyes book, and I believe the first book of the Genrenauts is out or about to come out.
Yeah, so Hexomancy was out in September, and it's the fourth Reyes story, though it's only the third novel. And the Reyes series, for folks who aren't familiar, is urban fantasy where fandom and love of pop culture and science fiction fantasy is a magic system. So in this series, Reyes, who's the titular character, could watch Terminator, being a huge fan, and then channel that kind of inexorable power and intimidation of a Terminator and be able to shrug off a few bullets by using that magic. So the main character is a big geek, informed by kind of my experiences growing up as a geek and kind of hanging out and working in a game store. So anytime when I revisit a major geeky touchstone for me, it's fun to then think about how that applies in the series. So Hexamancy kind of concludes the first arc of that series. And if you like kind of the idea of fandom having a big impact on characters in a setting, or fandom and geekiness as magic, do check it out. Genrenauts, The Shootout Solution, comes out November 17th. So that is coming very soon. And Genrenauts, in brief, is a setup where the main characters are all storytellers, and the Genrenauts jump between dimensions, and every other dimension than ours is the home of a narrative genre. So there would be the action world, there would be a romance world, and the heroes, the Genrenauts, go to those worlds and fix broken stories in order to protect Earth. Because if the stories continue to breach and go off track, it ripples back and kind of alters reality on Earth.
So that's November 17th. So you're going to seriously make me wait that long.
I can send you the EPUB now because you are my dear friend.
Okay. Well, I'm gonna lord that over people. So maybe go that's not a good idea. No, I'm just kidding.
We should totally hear about what Rachel's got going on.
Yes, Rachel, you've got an anthology that you want submissions for, correct? And I think we talked about this a couple months ago on Sean's Rambles, but now that's actually open.
Yes, now we're open for submissions. I'm editing an anthology for Alliteration Inc., and the anthology is called No Shit, There I Was. And the requirements for the stories, I mean, you can go to No Shit, I think it's noshit.alliterationinc.com. We'll do a link in the show notes or something. But the main requirements, beside the technical stuff like word count, is the first line of the story must be No Shit, There I Was, and it must have a speculative fiction element. That's it. And I want to see what people can come up with something that wide open. And we've already gotten some very interesting stories, and I want more. I want from all walks of life, and I want LGBT people, and I want people of color to send me things, and I want everyone to send me things. Send me things.
We'll work on getting a Terminator to send you a story.
I would love a Terminator No Shit There I Was story.
It would just be after that, it would just be kill, kill, kill.
Murder.
It's actually a drabble.
Pretty much.
Perfect. Well,
oh yeah, it is noshit.alliterationinc.com.
Perfect. I'll make sure there's show notes in there so that folks can go to everybody's things, Brad's website, Mike's website at michaelrunderwood.com, all that good stuff, and of course the website for the anthology so folks can submit. So thanks so much, Brad, for coming on and talking to us and just having a blast.
Thanks for having me on. This was really great.
Yeah, I like thanking you for having fun. It's a very strange way to thank people, but
it was fun though.
Oh, I'm glad it was. It's good. And obviously thanks, Rachel, for being you.
You're welcome, citizen. You're welcome.
And Mike, I would thank you, but you're wrong about comics, so.
Well then, thank you for letting me continue to be on the show despite my constant wrongness.
It's just but you're on thin ice.
With you.
You're on thin ice.
It's just to make Sean look good that you're on.
Anyway. and obviously, if you guys want to support our show, you can do so on Patreon, which is cool. Go to patreon.com/skiffyandfanty. And there are all kinds of cool milestones we want to do, like a World SF Tour thing that we can't do because we're poor. So if you want to help out with that and show your love, you can go there. And on that note, folks, awkward ending. And
if you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org. Thank you.
just another weak human afraid to face death.
I fart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you. Always.
This is Ripley, last survivor of the Nostromo. Signing off.